Good morning. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Obesity is a complex disorder that affects 40% of adults in the U.S. and nearly one in five children. The root causes of obesity are a combination of genetics, environment, dietary habits, and a lack of physical activity. The health complications of this serious condition include diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, osteoarthritis, certain cancers, sleep apnea, chronic pain, and stroke. In addition to these health problems, obesity also contributes significantly to serious mental health problems like depression and anxiety disorders. Many people who struggle with this condition have tried countless times to lose weight through any number of diet programs, attempts at exercise, or diet pills. For those whose obesity has created serious health risks and has resulted in a significant loss in quality of life, a surgical approach may be the best option for helping them lose weight and keep it off for good. Stay tuned with us for the next hour as Anchorage bariatric surgeons Dr. Sean Lee and Dr. Justin Clark look at the causes of obesity and discuss the risks and benefits of bariatric surgery. Welcome to the program. I appreciate you both taking the time to join me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. I really am going to try to avoid calling you Dr. Stanley. Like, I don't know why that keeps, you know, popping into my head.
Sorry, no relation.
I want to remind listeners, if you have a question or a comment about today's program, please feel free to give us a call. Our local or Anchorage number is 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, you can reach us on our toll-free number. That's 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to reach us is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Before we get started on our discussion today, I need to disclose that Dr. Clark and Dr. Lee own and operate Anchorage Bariatrics, which is an underwriter for Alaska Public Media. All right. Tell us a little bit maybe about yourselves and what you're doing at Anchorage Bariatrics. We can start with you, Dr. Clark.
Sure. My name is Justin Clark. I came out to Alaska in 2012 with the Air Force as an Air Force surgeon. And when I got out of the Air Force in 2016, went ahead and started Anchorage Bariatrics up here. A little background, I grew up in California, in San Diego, spent a lot of time traveling for school, for military, did medical school at Northwestern in Chicago, residency in the University of Hawaii in Honolulu, and then did a fellowship at Duke University for bariatric surgery, where Dr. Lee and I met.
All right. Why bariatrics for you?
Oh, for me, it's simple. I started doing it as a medical student and fell in love with it. It's very different than many other specialties, especially you get a patient that's extremely motivated to change their life, which is very different than someone coming to you with maybe a cancer or a trauma or something else. So motivated patient, and we really have the ability to change someone's life so drastically that the real benefit, the real joy of it comes in after surgery when we're following up people for months and years and really get to see the impact of what we do.
Okay, Dr. Lee?
Yes, I guess I can start kind of with the background. I actually grew up in Seattle area and went away for college and medical school, did my residency and training at Duke where I met Dr. Clark. And a few years later, you know, and he was up here in the Air Force, he had called me and told me what a great area this was and felt there might be an opportunity to start a practice here. And, you know, so I came up and took a look at Alaska and really fell in love with it. And I've been up here for about a year and a half or a little bit more now. As far as why bariatrics, I think very similar to Dr. Clark, you know, when you go through medical school and especially in surgical training, you see a lot of very sick people. And it's a wonderful thing to take somebody who's, you know, critically ill or even dying and be able to stop that. And it can be very dramatic, but it can also be very difficult because sometimes you're not as successful as you'd like to be. Bariatrics is one of the few areas in surgery, at least, where we're being primarily preventative. You know, the goal is to try to get people before they get really sick. That's not to say they don't have a lot of medical issues, and obesity itself is an important and potentially fatal disease, but we can make those really significant impacts on relatively healthy people and see that benefit for years to come.
All right. So what does bariatric mean? We're using bariatrics and we're saying that word. What's the meaning of bariatrics?
It's, you know, bariatrics is sort of a nondescript term, and it has to do with pressure and traditionally describes the stomach. It's not the greatest term in and of itself, but sort of through an accident of history has become the term that we use to talk about surgery on the stomach for purposes of weight loss and metabolic change.
All right. The first thing, I guess we should probably start with some of the numbers. I mentioned in the intro some fairly alarming numbers. We have, you know, almost 30%, 39% nationally of overweight adults or obese adults. And there's 1 in 5 children. So what are we looking at nationally, and how does Alaska stack up with that, Dr. Clark?
Yeah, so if we look at the latest numbers, you know, the media throws around this term of the obesity epidemic a lot. And it's a strong word, epidemic, but it really is a very accurate term. If we look at the numbers right now, the obesity rates for adults in Alaska is 34.2%, which means over a third of all the population in Alaska is actually obese. But even the more concerning numbers, to give you a sense of ranking, that puts Alaska as 9th in the United States, so pretty high. If we look at kids, most concerning the ages between 2 and 4 years old, the Alaska rates are 19%, which is actually 2nd in the nation in terms of obesity rates. The good news is it's slightly down than last year, but still, this kind of indicates that we're going to be dealing with this problem for a long time.
Yeah, weight problems seem to be a significant issue in our society, and we'll get a little bit more into some of the social and cultural, but we're in this fast food, highly packaged processed food environment that seems to contribute to easy consumption with an awe factor for your brain that's with easy delivery, and you can just consume mass amounts of calories at one sitting. Plus our proportion size is like supersize everything. That was a great movie, Supersize. All right, so what is obesity versus overweight? What puts somebody into the category of being obese? Dr. Lee, you want to take that one?
Yeah, so from a medical perspective, we use the BMI or the body mass index to define obesity and overweight. And there's different categories of obesity based on that. BMI, body mass index, is a way of taking one's weight and sort of standardizing it to height. It's technically body surface area, but that's approximated by your height. So, i.e., if you weigh 250 pounds, it's a very different health impact if you're 5'2" versus if you're 6'9". So that's why BMI is important, but it has its limitations. So you take your average NFL running back, they may well have a BMI well into the obesity range, but their body fat percentage, which we think is probably a better measure of health, is body fat versus fat-free body mass. Their body fat percentage for that NFL running back is going to be low. So BMI has its limitations, but that's, again, through kind of the history of healthcare been the primary marker. So BMI of about 21, 22 is considered quote unquote ideal. That's lower than a lot of people would even aim for their weight to be, but the normal range is around 21 to 25. BMI of 25 to 30 is considered overweight. Any BMI 30 or higher is considered obese. And you can get into categories of obesity beyond that.
Yeah, so there was obesity 1, 2, and then morbidly obese.
Yeah, there's, to be technical, the 30 to 35 is called class 1, 35 to 40 is class 2, and above 40 is the term morbid obesity, which we don't really love using.
It's an antiquated term.
It is. And really, the number of what your BMI is helps us determine sort of what you're eligible for in terms of treatment options. And a lot of those are based on really old guidelines, but still we do follow them.
I'm glad you mentioned the NFL running back, because the example is Herschel Walker, running back for the University of Georgia and others. He would definitely qualify as obese under the BMI. LeBron James probably would qualify. But these are massive men, massive human beings with tremendous muscle density, and they are, I mean, muscle weighs more than fat. Is that the reason for their...
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the areas that we invested in our practice was a body composition scale that gives us readings for patients of their fat percentage, their visceral fat scores, their fat-free mass, their muscle mass, so we can actually make really good decisions beyond the BMI.
I just like to think that's why my BMI is high, because of
you're very muscular.
The dense musculature. Yeah, it can't be other things.
Well, you know, it is a danger. You know, is that you think is to either way. You know, is try to assume, oh, I'm big boned and that's it. And that's not always the case, of course. But really, looking at your body fat percentage can be helpful. And there's a lot of inexpensive bathroom scales. You know, that you can get at any sort of these any store. You know, a Walmart or Target type place. That you can help manage that. In another way, we encourage people just to, you know, circumference. So if you notice your clothes are fitting looser, if you actually go to the point of measuring your waistline, your arm diameter, circumference, it can be a good indicator that your health is improving, even if the weight itself is not changing dramatically. Especially as you start working out, those, you know, as you build muscle, you lose fat, your weight doesn't change dramatically, and neither does, therefore, does your BMI. But that doesn't mean you're not getting healthier.
Right. All right. If you're just joining us, my guests are bariatric surgeons, Dr. Sean Lee and Dr. Justin Clark. On today's program, we are discussing health problems associated with obesity and the risks and benefits of bariatric surgery. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us in Anchorage at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, I want to talk a little bit about this idea of a fast versus a slow metabolism, and is that, I've heard it said that that's really not, you know, for a while I was like, oh, he's just got a fast metabolism. And I have a college roommate who looks the same no matter what he eats, and I can gain weight really quickly. So is it a metabolism thing? I guess that's, we're getting into the causes of obesity, which is probably a long conversation. But let's start off with that and then go more into the causes.
Yeah, well, I think the data on, you know, metabolic differences between people is very difficult to interpret. So right now, when you get into the sort of cellular or molecular biology of metabolism, you know, that term metabolism is so nonspecific because it's basically describing any energy-consuming process in the body. So basically everything you do affects metabolism. How calories are shuttled between cells and how they're absorbed from the gut and how they're utilized overall in the body, therefore becomes an extremely complex question. And so you can find one pathway that's saying one thing and another one that's completely contradictory. So it's been very controversial, I think, over the last 10, 20 years as to whether that there's a true metabolic difference based on genetics or not. I think that now we have mounting evidence that there really is. There are definitely genetic factors that play into obesity, but there's also environmental factors. There certainly seems to be changes in metabolic rate with age. There certainly seem to be changes in metabolic. And I think if there's one modifiable thing you can do is certainly exercise. you know, is regular aerobic activity for more than 30 minutes a day can really change your resting metabolic rate.
Okay, before we get further into some of the causes and what we can do about it, we have a caller. We have our first call. Sandra, you're on line one. Go ahead.
My remark is that I had gastric bypass 15 years ago, and I was 65 years old. I'm now 80. I can get up and down stairs. My knees don't hurt. My hips don't hurt. You know, I wonder what you think of the difference between gastric bypass and gastric sleeve is. I had the bypass.
Okay. Thank you for the call. And I think that goes to the point of what the doctors were saying of why they do this, why they're in this field. Dr. Clark, you want to take Sandra's call?
Sure. Sandra, thanks for your call. I'm very pleased that you've done so well. And I think doing this even at 65 is such a useful option for people, help you live longer, be happier in the second half of your life here. And I think one thing that we hear a lot, or I hear a lot, is that the biggest complaint among people who have had surgery is that they really wish they would have done it sooner, because the benefits can be so good and so life-changing. To specifically answer your question about bypass versus sleeve, it's a complicated question. Both Dr. Lee and I do both procedures very frequently. Nationally, the sleeve has become the primary operation among bariatric surgeons, where it used to be the gastric bypass. There's a lot of different considerations that we go through as to which procedure may be better for different patients, and it's really tailored to each patient's own medical history. In general, I would say that most patients that we see are going to do great with either the sleeve or the gastric bypass. And I can talk a little bit about really what those two operations are. But there are certain factors that contribute to perhaps, you know, diabetes. A gastric bypass is probably a better diabetes operation. And it's better for people that have really bad heartburn or reflux or Barrett's esophagus. Whereas the sleeve doesn't result in as many vitamin and mineral deficiencies, and it doesn't have risks of internal hernias or some other complications that the gastric bypass does. So there's a lot of subtle differences, and really that's where we get into detail about each patient's own history.
All right. That brings up a really interesting question for me is, like, gastric bypass is always, it's been sort of promoted as kind of a last resort intervention for significant obesity problems that are related to chronic health conditions. But what you're saying is perhaps it's not a last resort, but more of a intermediate intervention. And I do want to talk more about after the break, we'll talk more about the different procedures, because this is surgical interventions. And my understanding is there's quite a few of them ranging, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But last resort versus, like, when would somebody really seek this out as an appropriate time?
I don't think there's one answer for everybody. As a general statement, I would say people tend to wait longer than I think they maybe should. And like Dr. Clark mentioned a minute ago, the most common comment that we hear after surgery in regards to when patients had, as far as the timing of their surgery, when they chose to do it, they wish they'd done it sooner. So previous to me coming up to Alaska, I was at the Augusta University, which is the Medical College of Georgia, and we did have an adolescent program. They had a very large children's hospital there. We were not horribly aggressive doing surgery on youngsters, but we did have several patients that we were monitoring and helping with non-surgical weight loss. So we then eventually did surgery when they became older teenagers, into the 18 range. I think if you are struggling with severe obesity, if you have tried multiple diet plans and given it really good, solid effort for a few years at least, and especially if you're starting to see some of the health problems associated with obesity coming up, I don't think it's a wrong decision to do surgery, you know, even in the 20s. The data we have available to us, you know, gastric bypass has been done and been well studied since the 1960s. And the data we have is that most people continue to see long-term benefits for at least 25-year follow-up.
That's significant. All right, if you're just joining us, my guests are bariatric surgeons Dr. Sean Lee and Dr. Justin Clark. On today's program, we are discussing the health problems associated with obesity and are taking a look at the risks and benefits of bariatric surgery. After this short break, we'll return to our discussion. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media.
Dare to be the one to make a difference in the life of a child. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Get involved. A caring adult can make a lasting impact on a child's life. Know the signs and help prevent child abuse and neglect. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. My guests today are bariatric surgeons Dr. Sean Lee and Dr. Justin Clark. We are discussing the health problems associated with obesity and looking at the risks and benefits of bariatric surgery. If you have a question or a comment about today's topic, please give us a call to ask a question, or if you just want to make a share your own experience, perhaps, send us an email. Our Anchorage phone number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to get on the air is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, before the break, we were talking about a couple of the different options, and we had a caller who asked about gastric bypass and shared a very positive experience. But then, Dr. Lee, you brought up children, and that seems to me like a really sticky point. And you mentioned an honest effort. If you've really efforted to, there's a couple things I'm thinking here, but if you've really efforted to lose weight, but so much of the weight loss thing is like procrastination. Next time I'm going to do it right. Next time I'm going to stick with this plan. So an honest effort, it seems like, is probably individual. And so what qualifies as an honest effort, I guess, in your opinion?
Well, I think, again, most people have made multiple honest efforts. And one of the fundamental physiologic changes is, and the natural pathway of obesity as a disease, is that people can lose weight. You know, we've had really good studies of obesity and weight loss through diet and exercise since the 1940s.
Yeah.
So we have 70 years of data, and it demonstrates the same or very similar pattern. If the follow-up is long enough, more than about 2 years, you generally will see the average of a group of people studied doing whatever diet plan, exercise plan is being studied. They generally will lose weight over the first 3 to 6 months.
Yeah.
And then you kind of hit this plateau, and eventually the weight comes back plus a little bit more. And so that's been the experience of almost all of our patients prior to surgery, is weight loss with gain plus a little bit more than where they started. So over the years, it's the slow accumulating weight gain. You know, and that I think really gets at the idea, you know, we talk about these things still in relative abstractions, because it is such a complex and poorly understood physiology. But there's this idea of the body having a weight set point. It's not a totally foreign idea. If we break it down, something I think that's a little more understandable to a lot of people is hypertension, where the body has a set point for your blood pressure. And when you're at rest, you know, your blood pressure should be, you know, under 120 as a higher number and well under 80 as a lower number. But for some folks, that blood pressure set point changes higher. With obesity, the set point for your, you know, all of our weight should be hitting that BMI in the kind of 23, 24 range, or a little lower even. But for with that disease, those set point aspects of your physiology have changed and are driving you to gain weight. And that can mean 100, 150 pounds of excess weight. When you then are doing a good diet plan, and there's not, I don't think, one right and one wrong answer. There's a myriad of things out there, and I think a lot of those things have fundamentally similar ideas. I think when people give a good effort at that, it's they're often successful in the short term, but the physiology eventually wins out.
It is your body essentially pushing you back to it, what it has set as its normal. I mean, it's sort of a natural state. And it, like blood pressure you mentioned, it could be different for different people. Like somebody's blood pressure could be healthy at a higher level, and somebody's weight could be okay at a little bit higher level. Depends on the person. It's very individualized.
I think a couple of comments along that line is that, you know, obesity is a disease. And a lot of people don't consider it a disease. They consider it a lifestyle choice, but it is a disease. The American Medical Association characterizes it as a disease. And it's just, it's something that needs to be treated. If you have high blood pressure and you're put on a high blood pressure medicine, your blood pressure is probably going to become normal. But when you come in and I check your blood pressure, I say, okay, your blood pressure is normal. We can take you off your medications now. That's not the fact. You have to continue to treat that for the rest of someone's life, usually. Same thing is with obesity. Someone comes in, they're obese, we treat them, we get them down to a normal weight. You have to continue the treatment lifelong, or this is a disease that can recur.
Okay, this we have a caller, which leads into, I think it goes right along with my question about children. So we'll go to Paul, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Say, I was wondering what the research says about motivating students with intellectual disabilities to move so they can decrease their BMI. I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
That's a great question. I had a foster home for a long time, and I had several young folks that came in with disabilities and Asperger's or autism, and to get them motivated to eat differently, even at 16, 17 years old, was an incredibly difficult task because of the self-regulation just was not there. You guys, either one of you have any experience with that?
You know, honestly, I'm not that familiar with that literature on that topic. So for children with disabilities, certainly it adds another layer of difficulty. To some extent, though, I think it uncovers sort of the same physiology. If they're not able to have the same kind of thoughtful oversight of what they're eating and are a little bit more reliant on that kind of their instinctual, what their desires are, right? I mean, we're actually all trained in this country and a lot of other countries from a young age as to what we like to eat. What food is quickly available to us, and that is one of the problems with, you know, we talk about the multifactorial cause of obesity, and one of them is environment. And depending on where you live, the food environment can be very challenging because there's not a lot of healthy options. And almost no matter where you live in America, there's probably more access to quick and easy food or things like fast food chains. You know, quickie stops on along the road at a gas station. So, which not always offering, you know, and these are generally packaged, processed foods. So when you have children of any ability or disability level, that can make it very difficult to change habits over time because they just haven't developed the kind of understanding that's required to try to, I think, mentally overcome that. Unfortunately, the data shows that for about 97% of adults, long-term aren't able to do that either consistently enough to maintain weight loss.
That's a big number.
Yeah. And that's among people that are obese. So if you take obese patients that have already become obese, only about 2 to 4% of people can sustain any sort of weight loss.
Long-term diet and exercise.
Yeah, and part of that has to go back to the set point, which is what we describe obesity more as a biological response to our modern environment. And it has to do with a lot of different things. What increases your set point? Why does your body want to live at 300 pounds instead of 180 pounds? Well, it has to do with a lot of factors, the chemical and nutrient contents of our food, stress, inadequate sleep, weight gaining medications, lack of physical exercise. You know, there's a constellation of factors that contribute to that.
You're saying it's complicated.
Well, it's complicated.
Like healthcare.
And it is. And that's why surgery is such an interesting solution to this problem. And we used to think that, okay, we're going to make the stomach smaller, whether that's with a sleeve or a gastric bypass. So patients just can't eat as much, right? That's their problem. They're eating too much. Well, that's not actually the problem. And the more and more research that we do, we find that changing the stomach is actually changing the hormones in the stomach, which we can measure. And probably the primary drive in weight loss after these surgeries is hormonal and not restriction of food.
Interesting. Okay, let's go to the phones one more time. We have Alice. You're on line one. Go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
Yes. If someone is wanting to lose weight but cannot, I invite him or her to come to Overeaters Anonymous. There is no dieting, but help to attain a sustained food plan. Get off the junk food, have fellowship with others who want a healthy path to proper eating. Support is important. Call 907-250-3138 or go to oa.org. to find meetings in Anchorage. There are meetings around the state, around the clock, phone meetings, and online meetings. Having been a member of Overeaters Anonymous for 40 years and maintaining a healthy body weight, having fellowship and support against the continuous barrage of junk food everywhere you go, I really recommend it.
All right. Thank you, Alice. That's a community support, a group of people. It's much like Alcoholics Anonymous if you have a drinking problem. Food can be very addictive, and it often, I say addictive, I use that term because I do see it in my office. People eat for comfort. They eat for pleasure. They eat because they're lonely. They eat for a myriad of reasons. But that awe factor, high fat, high sugar food. So is something like OA, I'm sure you see many people that come through who have participated in that to some success or another.
Yeah, I think programs like that are phenomenal. And having that kind of support and it is a really key in any kind of weight loss and health effort. Part of most large bariatric programs in the country, including ours, have support groups. Which is a very similar thing. Of course, it's a little more tied to the surgical treatment arm, but really anybody's welcome to attend those as well. I think a community-based program like that is a really phenomenal thing. And again, do what works and what helps. And if that's successful for you, then that's a terrific thing.
I think habits of mind, I mean, this takes me back to the nature versus nurture debate with any sort of habits of mind that we create. We see healthy families that are very active. Their kids are biking, they're running. The adults in that family are usually biking and running. And then we see other families that may have consistent weight problems generationally. And there's a lot of sedentary lifestyle, inactivity. That is the same as any other habit of mind that we create. And so that speaks to children who are really, really heavy, and I've worked with quite a few. It's a tough one because you can't undergo bariatric surgery before development's full, can you, Dr. Clark?
No, really, adolescent bariatric surgery is done in select centers. We don't do that here. But certainly
extreme circumstances, right?
Extreme circumstances. The important thing is that bone growth is complete prior to you doing a surgery like that. We would certainly consider it down to a certain age. We do have patients that come in at age 12, 13 sometimes, and that is generally more of a conversation that's directed towards the parents and try to teach them about diet a little bit better. You know, diet is an incredibly driving force in all of this and the type of foods that we're eating. You know, you can exercise a lot, but you can't exercise off a bad diet. You know,
right. No matter
it
how
has
much work
to come
you
in
do.
Combination, and to the point of the caller, support is really important. Relearning how to eat is a huge component. We have a registered dietitian in our program, and also with mental health and the emotional connections that people make to food are sometimes extremely unhealthy, and that's why everybody who undergoes a surgery has to undergo a full psychological evaluation prior to us ever doing an operation. So we really try to treat this in a multifaceted way. This isn't like, I'm going to make my stomach smaller, everything's going to be better. No, this is a complete life change, you know, from the most basic levels.
Okay, and I want to go into that after the next break, more of like what the expectations are and what the challenges are around changing that lifestyle. Fundamentally in many different ways. But we have a caller I want to go to real quick. Sarah, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is about...
I think you're breaking up. I think we've lost you. Sorry, Sarah. Okay, let's go real quickly. What are the different options for surgical interventions for weight loss? There's a bunch of them. So can you all explain those for us real quick?
Yeah, so according to the kind of latest numbers from the Bariatric Surgery Professional Organization, the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, about 60% of all surgeries done nationally now are gastric sleeves.
Okay.
Gastric sleeve, in short, is dividing the stomach in a lengthwise fashion. So you change the shape of the stomach from being sort of a large pouch to a very kind of narrow vertical tube, sort of a banana shaped is what it's often described. The reason it's called a sleeve is simply because it resembles the shape of the doctor's sleeve as they described it, not because there's some sleeve of something put over it. And that can be a source of confusion for folks. The second most common continues to be the gastric bypass. Again, before I forget, all these are generally done laparoscopically, meaning, you know, 5 to 15 millimeter incisions through which you place, you know, long, narrow instruments to accomplish this through
okay.
smaller and less problematic in, incision points. Gastric bypass is where you cut the top of the stomach such that you make a very small pouch out of the top of the stomach. You leave the remainder of the stomach kind of alone. It'll continue to function and drain through the normal pathway. And then you go down and cut the intestine in half, about a third of the length down the intestine, and then sew the downstream tip of that to that little stomach pouch. And then reconnect the intestine downstream. So you've really bypassed the way where food goes through. So it goes through the top of the stomach and then directly into the middle of the intestine. Less commonly done procedures. So bypass is about 18% of all bariatric surgery. Less common things would be, you know, the lap band. Several years ago it was very popular. The data that coming out of that is that long term it has become probably the least effective and most highly complicated, you know, so more likely to have problems over a 10-year follow-up period than the sleeve or the bypass. So it's not done as commonly, but it is still done, and in the right circumstance, there's potential. We really don't offer that in our practice
okay.
for a variety of reasons. Then there's a operation called a biliopancreatic diversion or duodenal switch, which is sort of a combination of a sleeve and a more extreme version of a bypass. That remains to be between 1 and 2% of all bariatric surgeries, as it has been for many years. It does have higher complication rates, and there's a lot more maintenance. But it is highly effective for weight loss and especially for diabetes control. And there's a few other things that are less commonly done as far as surgery.
All right, the band, is that what Rob Bryan did? I remember he was the football coach for the Jets, and he had a gastric, I think he had a band on, and he said he was taking it off because he was going to Italy and he wanted to eat.
Probably. There's various ways. It's the band is connected to a little port that goes under the skin, and we can adjust it in the office by accessing it with a needle and putting more fluid in or taking more fluid out to make it tighter or looser.
But and I imagine that is not what any surgeon or any physician would suggest, is that you take it off to when you want to eat. Like go to a different country.
And some of the appeal of the band was that it was considered a reversible procedure, but it's really not. The changes of the stomach are pretty permanent, and we want everybody to think of who's having surgery, as this is a permanent solution. Yeah.
All right. If you're just joining us, my guests are bariatric surgeons Dr. Sean Lee and Dr. Justin Clark. On today's program, we are discussing the health problems associated with obesity and the risks and benefits of bariatric surgery. After this short break, we will return to our discussion. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Line One, Your Health Connection is supported by a grant from the Alaska Mental Health Trust and listeners like you.
If you're just joining us, my guests are bariatric surgeons Dr. Sean Lee and Dr. Justin Clark. On today's program, we are discussing the health problems associated with obesity and the risks and benefits of bariatric surgery. If you'd like to join the conversation on line one, we can take your calls for probably another 10 minutes or so. You can reach us in Anchorage at 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 888-353-5752. And the last way is to email us your question at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, let's talk briefly about what are the health risks of being extremely overweight. Dr. Clark or Dr. Lee?
I think there's a lot.
Yeah.
The most common things, hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes. And these are things that we know cause a lot of what we call morbidity or damage to the body and mortality and death. Obesity itself carries approximately a severe obesity, about a 20-fold five-year mortality risk for a 45-year-old person. That we believe most of that comes through the effects of these other comorbid illnesses. But those are kind of the three big ones that we talk about.
Sleep apnea too.
But there's a lot of others. You know, sleep apnea is another very common one. There's, you mentioned even in the opening that a variety of cancers, and that list continues to lengthen, but certainly things like esophageal cancer, breast cancer, uterine cancer, some colorectal cancers. So it's a large variety of cancers that are much higher rates in folks with obesity than in lean individuals.
Sounds like it impacts the entire system in some way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the converse of that is that, weight loss impacts the entire system.
Makes everything better.
Hopefully, not always. A lot of things are genetic. High blood pressure is genetic. Sometimes sleep apnea can be centrally located. But in general, and the rates are on our website or on the ASMBS website, but we see drastic improvement in all of those systems, in high blood pressure, high cholesterol. Diabetes can sometimes completely resolve, if not drastically improve. For patients, which is a huge driving force for their long-term health.
Okay, we're going to go. We got the phones are lighting up now in the last 10 minutes. So we're going to go ahead and go to Keith. You're on line one. You have a comment? Hey, Keith, you there? Okay, looks like we lost Keith. We'll go to Brian. You're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm scheduled to get bariatric surgery here in a couple months. And I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes late last year. And I want to know, like, how is there a percentage of people who will, if I lose 100 pounds, will the diabetes go into remission? Is that always a set in stone, or is that only a small proportion of people where that happens?
It's a great question. Thanks.
So Brian, yeah, great question. The data is, and unfortunately, we can't tell you what's going to happen for you. All we can do is, you know, relate medical data, which takes, you know, 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 people and gives us a percentage of how many people will improve by how much. So after a sleeve gastrectomy, about 2/3 of people's diabetes will resolve, is the term we use, meaning people are off all medications and their hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of sort of chronic average blood sugar level, will normalize under 6.0. In the longer term, so at 5 years, though, it seems that after sleeve gastrectomy, some of those folks will have recurrent diabetes come back, but usually to a lesser extent than what they had originally. As Dr. Clark mentioned earlier, the gastric bypass is a stronger diabetes operation. So that at a year, you're over an 80% rate of remission, and at 5 years, still about 55 to 60% of folks are in remission for their diabetes.
All right, let's keep going. Thanks for the call. Let's keep going. Brenda, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Good morning. I have a question about, it seems that in the health community, our stomach biome has become very important and a lot more understanding of it now. And I was curious with the different bacteria, they make a person crave different foods. And I was wondering if the doctors have patients where things like this can relate.
Yeah, I'll take that question. So we are learning a lot right now about the microbiome, and that is really one of the driving research areas in bariatric surgery right now. I was down in Seattle last year at a research conference specifically geared towards that, where they're taking people's microbiomes and genetics, stool samples and blood samples before and after surgery, and trying to figure out what is going on, and also trying to predict, okay, these people did really well with their weight loss and these people didn't. Let's look back at the microbiome and the blood samples and see maybe there's a connection there. So it's really a very interesting research area. We don't know a lot about it right now. But certainly what we do know is that people after these surgeries crave different foods. Their taste changes, whether that's from the hormones or the microbiome, we don't really know. But it's incredibly interesting when you have people who crave sugar and carbs prior to surgery and that have no desire to have that after surgery. It does happen. Not in everybody, but it's a very interesting concept.
And the microbiome is a great example of one of the many things that is important in the physiology of weight gain and obesity. You know, when you look at when you have different bacteria in your gut, that can affect the types of receptors expressed on the cell surface of the cells lining the gut. Those receptors can change the signals that go into the cell, which change the signals that go into the body, which can change things like the types of bile acids your liver secretes. The types of bile acids that get secreted into your gut then change what type of bacteria is growing in there. So it's a big cycle, and that's just a very small area of the body's physiology that is tied to weight gain and weight loss. So, you know, it makes it very difficult to say, yes, if we change this bacteria, it's going to have an effect. And quite frankly, a single intervention like that, unfortunately, does not seem to be very effective in human beings. Surgery seems to be working by several things at once. And again, this is poorly understood, but one of those things is there does seem to be a change in the microbiome after these surgeries.
Seems like the more we know, the less we know.
we're definitely at that stage with obesity right now, yeah.
I've had several, to speak to your point, Dr. Clark, I've had several clients who have undergone a gastric bypass, and absolutely foods that they used to love, they just don't want anymore, and they've increased cravings for healthier foods. There was a dramatic shift for several of them. It's an interesting observation. Okay, Ruby, you're on line one. Go ahead. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I just had a question. So at one point, one of the doctors said consuming too much sugar and too many fats can lead to obesity. And I just recently started the keto diet, and I was just wondering what their thoughts are on that, because it's all about consuming fats.
All right.
Yeah, well, I think we have a lot of questions about the keto diet, and I think there is no solid evidence that I have seen that says there's any particular dangers to keto. It again comes back to how you interpret these diets. You know, I mean, people can become vegan, as a different example, and still be very unhealthy. You can still be obese. You can still consume too much sugar and fat, because there's lots of vegan sources of fat that remain unhealthy fats. You can do keto diet and focus purely on, and you know, if you take an Atkins or a keto approach, which is very low carb, keto, again, for those listeners who may not know, gets into ketogenesis, which is a shift in the body's metabolism. You know, if you give the body all three of the major macronutrients, fats, carbohydrates or sugars, and proteins, it'll generally prefer to metabolize the sugars. If you take the sugars away and really cut down on any, certainly added sugar and really low carbs at a limit per day, the body will shift and start metabolizing fats as a primary fuel source. What that does is leads to the development of ketone bodies or ketones. As just the natural byproduct of breaking down fat molecules. And those get released in the breath and in the urine. So people will note changes in the smell of their breath and the urine. And people will sometimes even be testing the urine to look for ketones to know that they're doing the diet strictly enough. I think that if you're eating healthily, you know, you can eat lots of vegetables, you can eat healthy lean protein sources, and you can get good healthy fats. So maybe a little, you know, olive oil is a relatively healthy, flaxseed oil, nuts and seeds, as long as you're not doing them in excess, because those fats, even when they're healthy, have high caloric density too. So it's not quite as simple as just saying I'm going to cut out the sugars, because if you eat, you know, nothing but bacon all day, not to knock bacon, we all love bacon, right? But
right.
But if you only eat that or you overeat certain things, that can be dangerous.
It seems like there's a new diet that comes out every 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
South Beach, Atkins, Paleo, I mean, just goes on, but it boils down to healthy habits, exercise, moving your body, consuming good foods, and a balance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When you talk about adding that exercise into it, it's important.
And important.
One of a bit of my, the touchy subjects is when patients come in and folks with severe obesity, yeah, they do tend to have a lot of joint pain, back pain.
It's not
problems.
Fun.
They can't just go up and go for a run. No, but that's not what we're talking about with exercise. You know, exercise your mind. Think about what you can do. You know, if it's a little pedaling thing where you can sit on your sofa and put a little pedaling thing on the floor and pedal. There's chair yoga. You know, you have access. We all have access.
Getting in a pool.
Low impact exercises. Utilize the internet. You know, YouTube has some great exercise videos. You just have to be a little careful first, and maybe you want to run it by your physician before you do it. But don't use that back pain as an excuse not to be more active.
Real quick, I mean, besides exercise for weight loss, it has so many ancillary benefits besides that. Even if you're not losing weight, stress relief, better sleep, more energy. There's a million reasons to exercise besides losing weight.
Real quickly, the risks people need to be aware of. What are some of the risks people should know about if they're going to go?
So very quickly, you know, We've developed Providence Hospital here now as a center of excellence for bariatric surgery. And with that becomes, you know, we nationally register all of our data, all of our complications. And what you'll see across the board nationwide at these centers is that the complication rates are extremely low. The major complication rates are very low. And so that's something we'll probably have to go into more in depth another time for. But, you know, these surgeries are now done laparoscopically. The vast majority of patients stay one night in the hospital. And for select individuals, we're doing these as outpatients. So that should tell you at least a little bit about the perceived complications of these procedures.
It's a team approach to this. It's not just coming in, getting surgery, going home, and everything magically happens. What is some of the other stuff that goes on when somebody comes in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as Dr. Clark mentioned earlier, even starting before surgery, we get you in with a dietitian. We have people see the psychologist. Those are parts of a kind of national guideline requirements for a bariatric surgical program. Some people will take full advantage of that. Some people kind of do the minimum to get through. I think post-operatively, kind of similar. You know, we have ourselves, our physician assistants that work with us, the dietitians, the psychologists, are all available to work with folks one-on-one in support group settings. And I think all that support, you know, getting in with something like Overeaters Anonymous or another support group on your own would be phenomenally beneficial after surgery as well, I think, for people who find any interest in that. We definitely encourage it. I did want to mention one other thing, is I don't want people to think that surgery is perfect, because one of the most significant complications of surgery is that there is about a 10 to 15% rate of people not losing the weight we would normally anticipate.
Okay.
And the interesting part of that is I'd love to say that's all the people who just didn't try hard enough, but it really seems to be those folks whose bodies just don't seem to respond to it. You mentioned earlier, you know, people you knew who had bypass and they just don't have any taste for sugary foods anymore, carbs. And that's a really good sign. That's saying, hey, look, this surgery has done the job. It's moved that set point. It's altered the physiology. Right. Their brain isn't even wanting those foods. Some people don't have that change. Sorry.
All right. Final thoughts. We're coming up against it. So, Dr. Clark?
For me, I would just let everyone out there know that if you're struggling with your weight and you've struggled for a while, just know that you're not alone. You know, this is a common problem. You don't have to feel bad about it or shame about it. There are a lot of options to help you, whether that's through our program, another program, or other options out there. But just please, you know, don't feel bad. Take advantage of the options and move forward.
Dr. Clark? I mean, Dr. Lee?
Yeah, I would add only to that, don't hesitate to come in. You know, you can talk to us. Go on the websites. Bariatric programs all over the country have really good websites that have good information. Yeah.
All right, Dr. Justin Clark, Dr. Sean Lee, thanks for joining us today. Next week, you won't want to miss when rock climber Craig DiMartino will share his remarkable journey back from a 100-foot fall that left him broken and fighting for his life. Craig will talk about the physical and mental challenges he faced trying to rebuild his body and how he found a new purpose for his life after the fall. Thanks to Amon Swanson, who handled the web editing for today's program. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.